Episode 4, Fleeing Russia.
These were professional thugs that have been hired by the KGB, known as the FSB in Russia today, but they're still the KGB.
Yukos, for those who are catching up with our story, was the second biggest oil company in Russia in the early 2000s. That was before its CEO, the Russian oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky, was thrown in jail and the company was driven out of business by the Russian government. The guy talking about the KGB is Bruce Misamor, the American Khodorkovsky hired as chief financial officer. Misamor is referring to an incident in 2006 in which his home in Houston was burglarized while he and his wife were out having dinner. A police report from the night of the burglary nonchalantly mentions the possible suspects. Quote, complainant says he thinks it may be the Russian KGB that broke into his home because he is in a lawsuit with the Russian government. The complainant said that he was the CFO of the largest oil and gas company in Russia and that the Russian government stole the company and put its president in jail. I'm Lauren Steffi. Welcome to Episode 4 of Putin's Oil Heist, an insider's account of the Yukos affair told by former company executive Bruce Misamor. Today's episode, Fleeing Russia. Before we get to the home burglary, we need to go back a few years and pick up our story where we left off last time. Yukos was drifting toward insolvency. The Russian government had saddled the company with crippling, and Misamor claims, illegal tax liabilities. Tensions between the government and the company were growing by the day, and Misamor had been warned he might be a target for prosecution. He took a trip to London to speak at an industry conference in November 2004.
So I was leaving my hotel room at the Intercontinental Hotel on Park Lane in London, and I literally was going out the hotel room door, and I received a call on my cell phone from a Yukos number in Moscow. I could tell it was Yukos, the identifier. And it was Alexander Tomerko's assistant. Alexander currently is in London, one of the Yukos expats in London. Anyhow, his assistant told me that Alexander had asked her to call me and tell me that I should not go back to Moscow because I was going to be arrested at Sheremetyevo Airport when I hit Sheremetyevo. So, of course, I took their advice and didn't go back to Moscow.
Misamor took the warning seriously. He remembered how Khodorkovsky had been hauled off a plane by armed guards during a refueling stop. And while Khodorkovsky had actively courted Western businessmen like Misamor, Yukos was now run by two Americans, which didn't go over well in Moscow.
You know, working together. But this is another thing that, of course, irritated the Russians and Mr. Putin in particular, was you had two Americans at the top of Russia's largest oil company.
But there was another, more pressing concern. Misamor's wife was still in Moscow.
My wife stuck around for about a week and a half because she wanted to say goodbyes to all of her Russian friends and American friends. And she had lunch with the ambassador's wife that following Monday and so forth and so forth. And so took her about a week and a half to get out of Russia. And of course, I had made arrangements with the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador at the time. Could you please watch over her? Because, you know, typical Russian habit in Stalin's day would have been to nail her to get at me. Oh, absolutely is a concern. And so I had the ambassador monitoring the situation for me because I was in London. And then I had Chevron's head of Chevron in Russia was a good friend. And his security guys actually were looking after her, and they told her she was being tailed. But they never harassed her. They let her out of the country. I think they wanted her out of the country, probably. Never used her to get at me. Although, in the Stalinist days, they absolutely would have.
Meanwhile, in London, Misamor changed hotels and fielded calls from reporters. He wasn't the only Yukos executive who had realized Moscow was no longer a good place to be. The company's American CEO, Steve Theed, and other members of the management committee, including Alexander Tomerko, had all left Russia in a matter of days. Theed's offices in Moscow were raided by police, and one of the company's vice presidents was arrested. The threat of arrests only increased the financial pressure on the company. Misamor became even more convinced that the Russian government was orchestrating a scheme to either take over Yukos or seize all of the company's oil and gas assets. After about a week, Misimore headed to Houston, where he and his wife still owned a home. She flew in from Moscow about the same time and met Misimore at the Houston airport. Misimore began talking to lawyers about what legal recourse Yukos executives might have to stop the looting of the company. During the time that he was in London, the Russian government announced an auction of Yukos's principal production subsidiary, Yugansenneftegaz, to settle some of the tax claims against Yukos.
Well, a brilliant lawyer, I'll call him brilliant if in case he's listening to the podcast, Mark Baker, came up with the idea of bankrupting us and getting us into a legitimate jurisdiction in the U.S. bankruptcy courts, where we might have a fighting chance, whereas we would have zero chance in Russia.
U.S. bankruptcy laws are unique. They allow companies to essentially freeze time while they figure out their next move, whether that's selling assets to raise cash, bringing in new investors, whatever. What Misimore and his lawyers at Fulbright Jaworski wanted to do was to use the provisions of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code to stop the ongoing persecution of Yukos by the Russian government. It was a long shot, but with the entire senior management team in exile, it was about all they had left. But there was a problem. A Russian company with no assets in the United States had no grounds for filing any kind of bankruptcy proceeding in the U.S. courts. Misimore hadn't planned to flee Moscow when he went on his trip to London. He certainly hadn't come prepared with the documents he'd need to put Yukos into bankruptcy in America. But he had one thing that he always traveled with, his laptop.
The basis for a bankruptcy filing in the U.S. of a Russian company was, one, my presence in Houston, personally as a top officer of the company, and two, my Yukos laptop computer, which was very significant evidence for the being able to have a site in the U.S. for the bankruptcy. It was me and my laptop computer, and those were the two things.
The laptop held a treasure trove of corporate documents.
All my Yukos records of everything, board meetings, all the corporate governance, all the accounting records, everything that would have come to me as the CFO of the company and member of the management committee of the company. Everything. And that I'd ever received pretty much on my company laptop. And I didn't have a desktop. All I used was a laptop. So everything was there.
The tactic worked, at least at first.
Well, the U.S. bankruptcy judge ruled that it was a legitimate bankruptcy, that she had jurisdiction, and that the jurisdiction was created by me and my laptop.
The filing created a court-issued injunction to stop the sale of Yugansenneftegaz. Misimore knew the Russian government would probably ignore the judge's decision, but he had his eye on a different target.
All the bank group they'd put together to finance them, I mean, they basically couldn't do it because they'd be defying a U.S. injunction and they had U.S. operations. So we basically stopped the auction of Yugansenneftegaz legally in the U.S. Of course, the Russians ignored it and Russia went ahead with the auction anyway, but they couldn't get financing from any of the international banks.
The move had caught the Kremlin off guard, but it wasted no time in responding.
Well, the Russians were stunned. Of course, the Russians brought in all of the attorneys they could right away.
The tactic bought Misimore and the other executives some time, but ultimately, it didn't work.
The judge in Houston had determined that the bankruptcy could not succeed because Russia was not going to cooperate in the bankruptcy. And so the bankruptcy got tossed because of the, she felt she could never have a successful bankruptcy with Russia not cooperating, and they were the largest creditor.
We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Putin's Oil Heist. Even without the international bank financing, Russia's government-owned oil company, Rosneft, was determined to go ahead with the auction for Yugansenneftegaz. It just changed tactics.
So what they did was they had a large Russian bank made the loan to Rosneft to make the purchase of Yugansenneftegaz, which was totally illegal in Russia for the bank to do that, but Mr. Putin told them to do it, so they did it. So the company that bought Yugansenneftegaz was a storefront in Tver, Russia, north of Moscow. It had no business history whatsoever. And within 2 days, the asset was sold to Rosneft. So, it was completely a hoax.
For more than a year, Misamor and the other executives tried to keep Yukos going. The company turned its London offices into its new headquarters. And he spent his time working between there and Houston.
Because I was in a state of permanent jet lag, going back and forth between London and Houston every week. But we did try to run the company by committee. We had named a manager in Moscow to basically be our liaison with the company. That worked marginally. We continued to have problems. And of course, he was never going to put himself in jeopardy with the Russian authorities. And of course, he kept getting threatened all the time by the Russian authorities. But the top management was all sitting in London and trying to run the company in Moscow out of London.
While Misamor was jetting between London and Houston, in Moscow, his old boss, Mikhail Hartakovsky, was on trial. In May 2005, Hartakovsky was found guilty and sentenced to 9 years in prison. But the Russian government wasn't done with him. Hartakovsky would face new charges, even as he was serving his sentence in a prison in Siberia. They weren't done with Misamor either. 3 months after Hartakovsky's conviction, in August 2006, Misamor and his wife went out for dinner in Houston. As they returned home and walked into the kitchen, he noticed some British currency that had been scattered on the floor. Then he saw that the back door had been pried open from the outside. He told his wife to call 911.
But I was also afraid that the burglars were still in the house. So as I went through the house, the first thing I did was I went and got my shotgun in case anybody was still there. But then, too, I went into my den and saw that they had stolen my laptop computer, my company laptop computer, which was sitting there. There were also two other laptop computers in the house that were sitting out in plain sight, and they didn't touch them at all. And the only thing they had touched in my office was anything with a Yukos logo on it. And they rifled through anything with a Yukos logo. And then they went upstairs and they found some things with Yukos logos on them. And those were strewn about the house. And obviously, we had come back. They were still in the house. And they had rapidly departed out through the back door. And the only thing they took, well, they took my company laptop computer and they helped themselves to about $30,000 worth of Janus jewelry while they were there. And they picked out nothing but the best.
The attention to Yukos materials and the number of other valuables that had remained untouched in the house told him that these weren't ordinary crooks. He tried to explain that to the local constable who responded to the 911 call.
And of course, I greet him with a shotgun in my hand. And so he comes to the front door and I said, I don't know whether they're still here or not. And so I think we need to do a search of the house. And I said, the KGB hired somebody to break into the house. And he kind of looks at me like, KGB, yeah, right. Okay, what fantasy world do you live in? And so, we searched the house, found nothing other than evidence that they departed very, very rapidly. And it was quite obvious that the KGB had hired some local Houston thugs to break into the house. When we looked at the telephone later, there were a series of calls that came into the house to make sure that we weren't there anymore, that nobody was picking up the phone. The police found muddy footprints behind the fence of my backyard where somebody had been observing my habits. Obviously, the house was being cased.
The next day, Misamor called the State Department and explained what had happened.
I was very good friends with the head of the Russia desk at the State Department and said, my house was broken into yesterday. I'm concerned that they put a bug into my desktop computer, which was already there, and maybe another laptop computer. Maybe there's some fingerprints or something. I don't know what all went on. So she calls the FBI. There's a permanent FBI liaison, apparently at the State Department. So she calls him. And they send out the FBI, they fingerprint the whole place, they do a search for any bugs, etc. And, of course, in doing so, they call the constable at Precinct 4 that had filed the report on the burglary. And they said, well, this is the FBI, the State Department's asked us to get involved in this case, this break-in. And, of course, the guy saying, huh? And little old Precinct 4 constable, who's getting a call from the State Department and the FBI about the KGB breaking into a house. And here he thought I was crazy. It was a revelation for him.
Misamor is convinced that the timing of the burglary and the Kremlin's ongoing prosecution of Hartakovsky isn't a coincidence.
They stole it. the obvious reason that they stole it was they were going to take the hard drive out and use it in the Mikhail Hodorkovsky trials in Russia. It wasn't against the company, it was against Mikhail personally, and they were hoping to find anything on my computer that they could help convict Mikhail. And of course, there wasn't anything there because he didn't do anything wrong.
Misimor never saw his Yukos laptop again. Fortunately, he had copies of everything on it.
I had had it backed up several times, so I have all the files from the laptop, even today.
Ironically, Misimor wasn't even working for Yukos by the time of the break-in. After a hectic year shuttling between London and Houston, he'd retired at the end of 2005. But before he left, he'd initiated another effort to try to protect Yukos' international assets. The details of that effort were on the laptop as well, and it would lead to even more legal troubles for Misimor in Russia.
You know, I'm still, today, under criminal investigation in Russia for the theft of $10 billion worth of Yukos assets.
I'm Lauren Steffi. Join us next time for Episode 5 of Putin's Oil Heist, Fighting from Afar.